Station number 15736, Ernie Tompkins, Reel 3.
Tompkins, Reel 3. Now, you were going to tell me a bit more about your training,
right?
Your flying training.
Now, this was at Bristol. We had our lectures in the university lecture hall. On this particular day, the lecturer came into the hall. He put his hat, his stick, his coat, and his gloves on the table. And he came to the front of the stage. He said, "I'm the engine merchant." Now that man was a Frenchman. And he gave us a lecture on the Clergé aero engine, 110 horsepower Clergé. When he finished, he said, "Any questions?" I said, Yes, sir. What's the question?" "Well," I said, "sir, this engine is rated 110 horsepower." "Quite right." I said, "Did you," he's a member of the firm, this man. I said, "Did you design that engine to produce 110 horsepower? Or was that a bonus?" Because I said, "The Nome and Lerone companies are each producing 100 horsepower rotary and a 90, and you come along with 110 I said, "Seeing it was all about the same time, did you design that with the intention of getting 110 horsepower?" He said, "What a remarkable question." He said, "I don't know what made you ask me this." He said, "You are right." He said, "It was a bonus." Now, he said, "When we found we were getting 110 horsepower, they had to do some research and find out why they were getting more power than they anticipated. And during the search, they found that the draftsman had located the gudgeon pin bosses slightly farther down the skirt than he should have done. The result of that was it pushed the piston up at higher the compression ratio, which gave them another 10 horsepower. So, and I can remember that. Now, I don't know whether this is a little bit perhaps off the record, what I'm going to tell you now, but it's not new in flying, but it's to prove my memory. And I think you agree, it's memory. I went, of course, this is all part, but I was at, just been commissioned. Otherwise, I was a second lieutenant, see. And a young fellow said to me, he said, "Tom, would you like coming to town with me tonight? Or this afternoon?" I said, I haven't got any money in the bank yet. I said, I can't afford that." "Look, Tom," he said, "I'm not asking you," he said, "to pay anything." He said, "You're my guest." "Oh," I said, "I'll come." So we went to town, he and I, and we went to the Strand Palace, and there was two ladies there. One was his sister and the other was his fiancée. So I had to entertain his sister while he devoted more attention to his lady friends. We had a nice meal at the Strand Palace, and we went to the theatre. Now, I got to tell you, I've only heard this once since. I've never seen it on paper, and I really had more than I got, but at any rate, we went to this place, And the Vicar of Mirth was on, George Robey, the Vicar of Mirth. That is flat curate's hat and all that, you know. He gave a recitation, and this is how it went. I did know the second verse, but I've lost a couple of lines, so I'll leave that one out. But he said, I move in a very smart circle. In fact, I was received by the mayor at the local town hall. They held a grand ball, and needless to say, I was there. I wasn't exactly invited. I just dropped in about 8 o'clock. My word, it was fine. They were just going to dine. My reception gave me quite a shock. They were also delighted to see me. Delighted is hardly the word, but they were all pleased when I came, there's no doubt. I'm bound to admit, some grumbled a bit. The fact is, I was chucked out. That's George Robey, going back all those years. And I got... My brother is awfully clever. He's a common man, so to speak. In Commerce Today, he holds quite a sway. His position is really unique. He's one of the heads of the city. A magnet, I think, is the term. Perhaps hardly that altogether, but he's controlled in a very large firm. Now, it goes on, he's doing very well as our Bert. And he finished up saying, the fact is, he sweeps up the dirt. After all that, you know. But that's like that cock in the knock of the vicars, that sort of thing, you know. I had a pretty good memory for all that. I can't remember whether I switched a kettle on at home or anything like that. But
Did they used to call you Tom then, rather than Ernie? Because you're Ernie now, and you said your friend called you Tom. Was that what they called?
That's short for Tompkins, you see.
Gotcha. Right. Sorry.
Yeah. They called me Tom. They always called me Tom, see. So
when you say you graduated B, were you tested before you graduated B?
No. I should have told you that. Normally, your program is set out what you have to do. This time, Captain Selby gave me a passenger, which is unusual. And the passenger was able to guarantee what I did, you see. I passed a test. I don't think there was, I did the height test. Now, he didn't come up with me on that height test. Oh, yes, he did, because we did the height test on the trip down to Gloucester at the same time. Of course, I oughtn't to tell you. You better switch this off from what I'm going to tell you.
Why is that?
Hey, it won't go down with the ladies.
Well, carry on then.
Well, and this is during, they use this during the conversation. The DH9 had a streamlined nose, you know that, don't you? And it was always called the flying penis amongst the crowd, you know, amongst the pilots. That was a card. Oh, do you see I took the Met officer up?
I
you have a look at that, Captain Lieutenant Poole. Test for weather, it says.
Right, what was that? Tell me about
that. Have you got test for weather?
I haven't found it yet, but if you tell me about it, what happened?
Well, this is stupid. No flying is allowed before the Met officer gives his consent, and he has to be taken up to prove the weather. And they asked me, and I hadn't even graduated. It's down there, left on a pool, test for weather. I was up about 10 minutes.
And that was just to fly it. And was the weather all right?
That was just, as I say, fancy asking me, though. I hadn't, you would have thought an instructor had been the one to ask, but I suppose I managed it all right.
Now, what about stunt flying? Tell me about that before we...
I did a couple of loops.
How would you do a loop? Can you remember now?
Well,
how would you do it with the...
Well, no. Say I got to loop the loop.
What plane would you use?
This one, that B2D. We couldn't loop any other machine we had. This was the B2D. It had no extensions. You see, I won't find many entrants to me with B2Ds.
Right. So what would you do then? If you wanted to loop, how would you go about doing it?
Say, if you want to loop to loop, you just ease your stick forward. Now, we say our normal speed is about 100 miles an hour. You ease your stick forward until you get perhaps about 120 on the clock. And when you've got that, you open the throttle to full throttle and put your stick back in your stomach. Now, when you see the horizon behind you, you've got to ease your stick forward again, but you also got to take a bit of rudder off. You've got a bit of rudder, because your prop torque finishes when you switch your engine off. See, you'd come out a bit skew if you didn't. Perhaps a lot of them didn't even bother to take the rudder off. You'd come out a bit sideways. For a roll, that's easy enough. You put on practically full rudder and pull your stick back in your stomach, see. that's what you do for a spin. You want to spin, you stall your aircraft and kick on the rudder. Which side do you want to spin?
How do you stall it?
Just cut your engine off and hold it up there. It'll flop forward. Now, you'll find in my tape, we were sat in the, I don't know if you've seen this, we were sat in the tender waiting to go back to Stamford in the evening. And they were, the driver was taking a check, and there was one fellow missing. So one of the chaps said, "Oh, that's Gardner's doing his camera gun." So we looked out, you know, and there he was, still doing his camera gun. So we watched, and he dived straight into the lake. Now, the reason for that was the DH6, what we call a pre-modified DH6, the tailplane would get in the slipstream of the main plane, and the elevator was a bit sluggish. You had to allow a little bit more height if you want to do any diving. He didn't allow enough. He went in. What I shall never forget is, now there was over 8,000 kilowatt training alone in this country. Well, we assume it's this country, but anyway, it's over 8,000 kilowatt. Now this this chap, I said, drive down the lake. All right, as soon as we saw that, all right, driver, and off he went. And we sang this. I've got a motto, always merry and bright. Look around and you will find every cloud is silver-lined. The sun may shine, although the sky's a grey one. I often said to myself, I said, cheer up, Tompkins, you'll soon be dead. It's a short life and a gay one. I used to sing that. That's the attitude you had to adopt. To say that it was dangerous, yes, it was dangerous. I've read some pure tripe in books. They get away with it. And I read some about Pendred. I got Pendred's articles, and it doesn't tell me what I know. But I would tell you this.
We'll come to Pendred when we get to the squadron. Can I just ask you? You were taking me through some stunts. How would you roll then? You said how you go into a spin.
Oh, that's a spin on the level. If you want to roll, you just go, you put your rudder on and put stick back straight back. You're on the level. See, when you whack your rudder on, normally the thing wants to swing around like this. But you pull your stick back and that stops that, and it starts rolling. It's so easy. If you want, as I say, want to do a roll, it's just that.
What about a side slip? I'm not quite sure what a side slip is. side slip.
Oh, side slip. That's easy. You put your stick over and then put a bit of opposite rudder on, so that if you want to approach the aerodrome and you're overshooting and you want a side slip, well, you push your stick down and put the opposite rudder on. If you put your stick to that side and put the rudder to the same side, you spin round the curve. But putting in the opposite, see, it just slips down in. So otherwise, it's you've got to. When we used to do that, the fallen leaf, that's a succession of side slips. You get into a glide. No engine, get into a glide. And that's what you do. You put whichever way you want to, put your rudder on, the thing will start, and then you push. Put your stick that side, then put your rudder on the opposite side.
Now, I know it's strange to ask, and I do know, but could you explain, just for the people who are not here, what the rudder and the joystick did? Do you see what I mean? How they worked? Do you think you can manage to explain that? I know it's quite...
Now, the joystick, obviously, controls your elevator.
See? Now, the elevator was...
That's right.
On the wings.
That joystick, as I say, well, that would put it over. Your ailerons controls your bank. You know, you've got the two ailerons. See? So... If you want to do it, I say, well, it's all it comes the same thing. Your stick, we used to call it the stick, see, because you've got your rudder, elevator, ailerons. Now, I often wonder why there was what they call a deproducing control. Whether they ever use them or not, I don't know. You've got your wheel for your rudder. You rock your wheel for your elevator, see, and you rock it, and you work it this side, like this, for your ailerons. It's all done with the same control, see. That's your ailerons, that's your elevators, and turn the wheel as you like to do in a motor car, as your rudder, see. But I don't know whether they ever use that now, but that was what they call a deproducing control.
And what was that on? What plane?
That was a French idea. No, I've never seen an aeroplane with it. Of course, we had a B-2B there that had wing warping.
What was that?
No ailerons. The wings warped.
Twisted.
They were flexible, see. They weren't very popular anyway. I flew one. I think it's in the log, but I had one flight with a B-2B.
Now, just
you wouldn't notice much difference anyway.
Now, just a couple of things to tidy up. The camera gun flights. What were you doing with the camera gun?
Well, the camera gun is it's a camera that takes a photograph of your target. So if you're on target, it will show up on your negative, see.
And what would your target be?
We used to have... a target in the middle of a lake.
That's what your friend flew into.
That's right. And that was safe enough, you know, for the public. See, no public could get near the target.
Was it easy to aim the aircraft? It was a fixed Vickers, wasn't it?
The what?
A fixed Vickers you were using, was it?
That's right.
Firing through the propeller.
That's right. They'd fire 900 rounds a minute. The land gun was only about 600. They fired like 900.
And was it easy to aim the machine to hit your target with either the camera gun or the Vickers?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I would say myself that the Vickers gun would be the more accurate of the two. I think the camera gun was a... you notice in that notebook, aerial firing. That's when I'd finished the camera gun, went on to aerial firing. That was more accurate. You'll see it there somewhere.
Were you an accurate shot in the air?
I don't know, I passed the tests anyway. That's all that mattered.
What about, were you ever given any lectures in air tactics, air fighting by anybody, by any of the aces or anybody?
I didn't catch that. You'd have to. You'd do that at the school of aerial fighting, not. We weren't supposed to look for fighting, we had a job to do.
So everybody at your school was going to go on to DH4s?
Yes. I don't know, I went to Sedgford, I didn't do any flying there. You read it there, see. Major Wynne Wilson sent me straight to France. I don't know what machines they were using there.
To Sedgefield?
Sedgford, that's what it's called, Bertram Newton, up in Norfolk.
Which squadron was that?
That was the training school, look. I don't know if any particular squadron, it was I don't know what they called, School of Aerial Fighting it was called.
So that was after the depot school?
That's right.
Now, how come you were sent to the Western Front straight away? Because you were sent to 202 Naval Squadron, weren't you? I mean...
Well, no, I only got to... I imagine it did happen. Of course, you know all about... That's what I'm going to repeat now, what's in the logbook. It was the Air Commodore that evidently had me sent there. Because if you read that, I went to Sedgford, and Major Wynne Wilson was there. He was the CO at Hastings Cadets, but he was there, an elderly man. And he said, Bristol. He said, you've been hanging around. I said, I enjoyed my flying, sir. He said, good, how would you like to go to France? Well, I said, isn't that the general idea, sir? He said, this is entirely in your interest, and I strongly advise you, that's his very words, strongly advise you to accept it. I said, I'm in your hands, sir. So the next day I was sent to, you could see how this, normally I would have gone to Saint-Omer, Marquise, Pilot's Pools. Instead of that, I went to Wissant, which is a small aerodrome. And when I arrived there, they asked me if I'd like to... I got an idea why. He asked me if I'd like to see the country. And I took up a DH-9.
Had you flown a DH-9 before?
No, only to graduate in it. If you notice in the logbook, it graduated B with a DH-9, first flight DH-9.
That's when you did your long flight.
I did the long flights, that's Sorry. Right. So when I got out there, the only flying I'd done at DH-9 was this graduation. In spite of that, I had this flight. The next day, I take up three Americans and show them the country.
That's now, the all 28th this is in, of September.
I got this all down on paper, but in my logbook. What happened there, but I didn't anyway, but I take up three Americans, and I did, and one a bit upset because I took him too near the lines. He had no ammunition, and a bit upset, and the CO took me off. He said, it was in fun really, he said, if you want to get yourself shot up the crack, he said, that's okay by me, but not in my machine. So, he gave me a poke like this, a bit of fun. Then I reported. Now, if you'll see, because I got to go back over some of what I got down there. When I arrived at Berg, I arrived there, went overnight, and arrived there by 8 o'clock in the morning.
Now, that's near Dunkirk, isn't it?
That's Dunkirk. Berg is Dunkirk.
And this is where you were going to join 202 Squadron.
That's right. That's 202 Squadron, see, at Dunkirk. So when I arrived there, had a talk, the CO said,
You haven't been flying DH4s, have you? I said, no, sir. He said, I get Captain Biles to give you a briefing. Now, we're going back onto my logbook, This Captain Biles had a forced landing at Hastings, an all right seaplane. And I was cadet group leader, which is all down there, cadet group leader, and I had to entertain him. And well, he got some mechanics out, see. He sent for Captain Bars, and when Captain Bars walked in, we shook hands. I can hardly believe it. He was the man that I helped at Hastings. And I said at the thought of the time, I'd like to be with that squadron, and he's going to be my flight commander. It's Captain Bars.
Now, what flight was that?
That was B flight, you see. And that was, this is the one I arrived there, you see. Now, the first flight.
You said he was going to brief you. How did he brief you? Said he was going to brief you in how to fly the DH.
Oh, I beg your pardon, yes.
How did he do that?
Well, what he did, I was sat in the aircraft ready to go, mine. He got up, looked into the cockpit, and he pointed out, for instance, the incidence wheel.
Now, what was the incidence wheel?
That was a tail trimmer. Well, he trimmed the tail, and we used that for taking off and landing. And he looked over and he said, well, how's your incidence wheel? I said, he said, we generally take off right forward and one turn back. To land right back and one turn forward. That's to set this wheel, see. And that helps you for takeoff and landing. And there was other things like the petrol, which I reported. Normally we used a pressure tank, but you took off on a gravity tank to get 2.5 pound pressure in your pressure tank. So you had to switch over as soon as you come up towards using your gravity petrol. And I nearly forgot it, as a matter of fact, in the first place. And then you refuel your gravity tank for emergency landers if you wanted it. And you had to turn that off because that would pump petrol over the top plane. Well, there was your oxygen we had. We had a cylinder like a fire extinguisher, like a small fire extinguisher, and a rubber bladder, something like a rugby football bladder, and you'd fill that bladder from
the cylinder.
That's right, you fill that bladder and have a suck out of that as you wanted it, see. That's something around about 17,000 or 18,000 feet. And there was the takeoff and landing speeds and oil pressures and our normal cruising speeds and all that sort of thing, you know, to do with the instruments. And because he explained all this, and off I went. That's all the instruction I got on that.
Did you have a passenger? Did you have a passenger on that first flight?
Oh yes, it's in there. I had a passenger. I said on my in my records, I said he was a brave chap to risk his neck, but he wasn't. My regular gunner was Tom Calvert. He was the son of Calvert's, their carbolic tooth powder people, that was in those days, you know, a pink powder, carbolic tooth powder.
Now, the plane you were flying was DH4-5997.
That's right.
You quite often see that. There's quite a well-known picture of that one.
No, wait a minute.
That's the you were flying that plane for a while.
That's right, for about three flights, I think it was. 5997.
Now, what was it like flying a DH4, then? How did it compare with the other DHs you'd flown?
This. You see, we had an engine of much greater power, 375 horsepower. The highest power I'd been in was about 230 horsepower, which was a Sydney Puma.